All right, so this is a little afternoon talk on traits that we want to infer for a fast evolving population. And this is the work primarily by Simone Pompei, who's a postdoc in my lab, and Thorsten Held, who is a PhD student. And of course, this is embedded into our work on influenza in collaboration with Marta and John. So as I would like to argue in this talk, that molecular traits and functions are in many ways a gap in our knowledge. This is already so if you think of a laboratory evolution experiment. We can nowadays sequence things in great detail, and we see a lot from sequences alone. We can do fitness assays. But the level in between is the one that we can access often in a most only in a more difficult way. Now, in a laboratory evolution experiment, you can try to do reverse genetics. You can try to get at functional and phenotypic and fitness effects of individual mutations on an individual background. But even that is already like a quite laborious exercise in many ways. But then here, look at this example, which I just picked as a fast evolving population in the wild. So here is the tree of the influenza population as it evolved roughly in the last 10 years. There's obviously, there's plenty of mutations. There is, many of them have functional effects. They drive a strongly selected process. There's the continuous evolution driven by the interaction with the immune systems. But how can we go about and see what exactly these mutations are doing? There is multiple possible phenotypes involved. The viruses have to bind to host cells. They are interacting with host antibodies. These proteins have stabilities. There's lots of things at the phenotypic level that this process is acting upon. But we know relatively little about it for such fast evolving populations, and this is sort of was the motivation for this work. So here's a brief outline. I will first run through some theory which you could think of as the quantitative genetics of in fast evolving populations. I will talk about quantitative traits in particular, their genomic signatures, and how we can infer them from sequence data. And then I will apply this to this example, which I've already alluded to the evolving process of human influenza. And I will look what traits we infer from sequence data and what evolutionary and structural properties can be associated with these traits. Now, so let's first get to what is going to be the basis of this inference, namely selection acting on these traits. And of course, this is a subject that people have worked on for years, and I will not try to comprehensively review this. This would keep us till midnight. Let me just state that there is sort of two ways of thinking about this problem. One that was started by Martin White and Terry Hua and collaborators, that wants to look at evolutionary correlations in the end concentrated on specific sites on proteins or on interacting proteins. So from broad correlations that are involved, there is an inverse problem to be solved to get to those sites that actually interact with one another and that are to be distinguished from the indirect correlations that are visible on other sites. Another sort of broad class of works specifically looks for another type of correlations, namely broadly distributed correlations. There's no attempt made to distinguish individual sites, to identify individual site pairs that are sort of more fundamental to these correlations. And these give rise to blocks of correlated sites that in some cases are associated with broader groups of sites in these proteins. And there has been discussions what these two approaches have to do with one another, what their relative standing is. And this is sort of part of the subject of this talk. I will argue that when we look at this in an evolutionary context, then there's a very clear association of these two broad methods with underlying biological notions. Namely, these are localized traits that are somewhere on the protein, like, for example, a specific contact at two points. And these broader correlations can be naturally associated with quantitative traits. So this is what I would like to sort of elaborate a bit on in the following slides. So let's quickly define what a quantitative trait is. And here I take the simplest thing, right? Take a number of genomic loci. Each of one has them has alleles, for example, just two alleles up and down, as shown here in white and black. And each of these sites has an effect on the trait. So we have a bunch of alleles and a bunch of effects. And the trait, or in physics language, the order parameter, is then just the weight sum of these effects. And so you can flip these alleles at individual loci and change the trait. And for a given genomic configuration, the trait, the population, or in an individual in a population, this trait is around a given point. Now, the point I would like to make is that there is, now let's put the simplest possible fitness landscape that you can think about, for example, a quadratic fitness function with maximum, so this is an optimal value. You could think of, for example, protein stability, that there's a fitness function. At some point, if the protein gets too unstable, it gets down. So anything that is not a linear function. So here, for example, I've just chosen a quadratic function, and this generates selection on each of these sites, namely, the selection at each site is just proportional to the effect of this site times the gradient of this fitness function. So if changing an allele at that site changes the trait a little bit, it will have an effect. So for example here, let's look at a mutation at one site I. So we flip here this selection, this allele from black to white at one of these sites. The trait, for example, goes down a little bit. There's an obvious effect at this site. It was maybe at the preferred allele. Now it's at the unpreferred allele. So the selection has changed from negative to positive at that site.
Can you be more clear about the design on the left with the arrows and that stuff?
Okay, so here is, again, the effects of these sites that we had. And here is the selection coefficient of these sites, and they are obviously proportional to these effects. So, and they are the selection at each of the sites that is at the preferred allele. The selection is negative; it goes down this arrow. But there are always a few sites shown here in white that are the unpreferred alleles. So these are under positive selection. So changing these alleles from white to black would move the trait a little bit upward on this fitness landscape, while changing it from black to white would move the trait a little bit downward.
Like gray bar.
The gray bars here are just the effects from the previous slide, right? So this is just the amount that each site contributes to the trait. This is a positive number, while the selection coefficient can be positive or negative, depending on whether that allele is the favorable allele or the
So that would assume that they're completely unlinked, right?
At the moment, we're not talking about linkage because we're just talking about selection. But then if we talk about the evolutionary dynamics, we have to talk about linkage. And in fact, for the examples that we're looking at, that the evolution will be under complete linkage. But so now if this site... So here, now let's just take an example. So this, there was this mutation at one site that caused the trait go a little bit down on this fitness landscape because this changed from a favorable allele to a disfavorable allele. So obviously this changes the selection coefficient at this site, but because the fitness landscape is nonlinear, it gets a bit steeper, so the selection coefficient at all other sites will change as well. In this case, they all get a little bit bigger because the fitness landscape gets a little bit steeper.
So I guess I'm so confused. This, the combination of alleles at the site, is that again an allele, and is the population monomorphic for this allele, or is there variation at each of the individual sites in the population?
This diagram, as shown, can be read in a single individual, right? So this is true in any individual. Whether there is substantial variation in a population is sort of a separate interesting question. For the examples we will look at, we'll think that the population is relatively narrow here on this, concentrated around a typical individual. But the effect, so what this slide is supposed to show is that the phenotypic fitness landscape causes generic epistasis between all the trait sites. You make a change at one site, selection will change at all other sites that contribute to this trait. So it's a particular way of generating broad epistasis between all the sites that participate in this trait. And in fact, the form of this epistasis is very easy. So this is this change in selection before and after the flip. It has to be proportional to the amplitude of the site that flipped first. It has to be proportional to the amplitude of the site in question. So here's the change in selection at site I given a flip at site J. It has to be proportional to EI, to the amount of change that was in the first site. And it's proportional to the amplitude of the site number J. And it has to be proportional to the curvature of this fitness landscape. So the message from this is, for a quantitative trait in such a simple fitness landscape, you just get a very simple epistasis matrix on the trait sites, which is a symmetric matrix. And the entry of this correlation or this interaction matrix at each entry I and J is just the product of EI and EJ times a scalar function. So this matrix is of rank 1. And moreover, all of its elements have a definite sign.
Yeah, I'm surprised with this. So you're saying it does not depend on the energy of the whole thing, the amount of epistasis. Because I would have expected, you know, that it's somehow where you are on that curve also.
This is true for a quadratic fitness landscape.
Yes.
If the curvature were to change, then the strength here would also be changing. So for quadratic fitness,
when it's quadratic, that then it drops out.
Then it drops out. But we have, if you, this is, I don't think for the practical analysis is it's a strong assumption, because if you think, for example, now of protein stability, the population is typical somewhere on this fitness landscape. There is a local curvature, and then with that local curvature, that picture is still correct.
It may not be, right? I mean, we know you can do single mutations that cause it to no longer fall, but proteins, that's easy.
Yeah, of course. I mean, this is the typical small effect mutations that make the evolution of quantitative state. Of course, if you think of protein stability, there can be always a mutation that makes this whole thing break down. So there's one more thing to this, and this has already this. We're going to the dynamics of this thing. If you now think you make a change at site number I, this is wrong here, this should be I delta S, delta S J. If you make a change at site I, then we set the selection changes at site J, but then there's actually a collective dynamics of all these sites. So there will be compensatory mutation, maybe at another site J prime. So the effect, it's going to decay over time. And in fact, it's going to decay with a characteristic time scale that is just the relaxation time of the trait. So that means a change at one trait site generates a time window where this epistasis acts. So you make a change, this changes to selection on all other sites. But then on the time scale that the trait relaxes again, from the perturbation of that first mutation, that epistasis is going to decay as well.
So is that somehow entrenchment?
What do you mean by entrenchment?
I mean, the fact that, you know, when you put one residue in within a protein, people then argue that later, independently of its effect, later on, if you subtract it, it's going to be deleterious. So you put a mutation that is slightly neutral, or eventually slightly deleterious in a protein, and then you wait, but you're going to adjust overall to that perturbation somehow. And now if you remove it, that same mutation now is becoming deleterious.
That could be a facet of this thing, right? So clearly, it's already clear from this picture over here, right, that the effect of any mutation that can even have, doesn't have a definite sign, right? If this, the trait average happens to be here, then everything that was a beneficial mutation before is a deleterious mutation, and so on. My guess is for the examples that we're studying, like protein stability, we are always sort of on a given part of such nonlinear fitness landscape, so the slope doesn't change sign. So you have relatively little sign epistasis, but of course, this depends on how complicated the problem on this fitness landscape is. So the message here is that the evolution of connotative traits is a way to generate very simple epistasis. This matrix is of rank one. That means that there's only one eigenvector and one eigenvalue, if you think about this this matrix. It's not rugged in any way. It's a smooth epistatic landscape. And we're going to exploit that.
Can you explain about this time scale?
Can I ask a similar question? So you're saying there will be a perturbation and then it will decay. By that you mean it will decay in the population?
If you have a mutation, this is true in an individual, but then also averaged in a population, then the trait is going to be a little bit lower than it was before. But then there is, if there were only these two sites, that would be it. That would be the amount of epistasis. But then there are other sites, because there are many sites, that are coming in, making changes. And that means that initial effect of the first mutation is going to be compensated, but not necessarily at the site in question, number J, but at the third or fourth site. And since through this collective dynamics, the selection is also going to decay. And after a while, the trait average is going to be readjusted to its long-term average, and the effect of that perturbation by this first mutation has decayed, and therefore also this additional effect on the selection of another site.
They say compensated, you're assuming the first one is deleterious? Or because
it can also be amplified? It can be either way, right? I've here, if you wanted to be very careful for actual selection coefficients instead of these amplitudes, then each of them has still two possibilities. It can have an up mutation and a down mutation. There's, for a given pair of sites, there are four possibilities and so on. But this is true both for deleterious and for so there's only plus minus ones to be added to this formula.
But this is only true if you at equilibrium at the end, at your trade optimum. Around.
This does not assume, and I think this is similar to Eric's question from before, in a quadratic fitness landscape, it doesn't matter whether you are it's the same at every point, because it's about the curvature of this landscape. It's about the additional effect that comes because the landscape gets steeper when you go in one direction or the other direction, or flatter, and that curvature is a constant for a quadratic function.
No, that's what I mean, but it makes no sense to talk about an equilibrium if you're not at optimum, because why would evolution go to an intermediate fitness?
There's many reasons why. For example, for a protein, it's known, right? So they are often, and particularly in our system.
Zen fitness, not true.
Fitness, right? So for example, the stability of these viral proteins, like in my introductory examples, is quite marginal because there's lots of mutational pressure that destabilizes proteins and so on. So we are not at the maximum fitness, but we are somewhere where these proteins are somewhere on that slope where they're just still working and not decaying. And I think this is for We're going to, let me come back to this when we talk a bit more about the biological context of this.
I guess it is.
When he's talking about curvature, so like, what are the x and y axis? Like, I guess if the z axis is your fitness, and like, the x and y,
the horizontal axis is the trait, and the vertical axis is fitness, okay, right? So this is just the phenotypic fitness function.
But do you rank the traits such that it maybe becomes, because like you could have like very discrete sort of, you know, fitness values, right, for every trait. So you know, you may not be able to talk about curvature.
Well, I mean, here we are sort of by definition assuming a quantitative trait, so which can be influenced by mutations at many loci. Think of protein stability, and then it makes sense to think of this as a continuum. But of course, there are other traits which live on few loci, which are Mendelian, and to which we're going to come later, which don't fit.
But like, maybe you explain me again, why the hell would you go back to the, somehow in this, not at the trait optimum?
Because you have mutation selection balance, basically.
So maybe
there's a mutation selection balance. Yeah, you know, there's ongoing mutations, and you are somewhere at a typical stability. Now, for example, one of these sites makes an amino acid change. This protein becomes a little bit less stable. You're going to slide a little bit further down in this landscape. It gets a bit steeper, and therefore there will be, after a while, there will be a compensatory mutation. This is just this equilibrium. But the selection coefficient on all these other sites is going to be a bit bigger if you go to something that's a bit steeper. That's in fact what triggers this extra amount of compensation that brings you back at the end of the day to this typical thing. On the other hand, if you happen to make a mutation that makes the protein a little bit more stable, the sliding to a little bit flatter part of this landscape, selection is a little bit relaxed, and so the next negative mutation is going to happen a bit easier, and you're also going to be back to your typical slope. So this is the picture of this egg.
What I'm not entirely clear is that selection doesn't vary through time, and it's overall the same. Well, I mean, selection coefficient is what. How do you set up the?
In this particular model, with it's still, we're going to vary it over time in a moment. Uh-huh. But in this particular model,
if you're lucky.
In a moment measured in slides, and so here it's just, you know, like protein stability, something that, you know, at a given value of say delta G, you have this or that fitness, right? And that doesn't change over time. So this is here the assumption. So
I think it's a totally reasonable toy model. No? You have linear mapping of the site states to some trait, and then you have a quadratic mapping to the fitness.
It's stabilized selection.
It's just a toy model, and it's okay, no? And near an optimum, probably the quadratic is not so bad.
Yeah.
No, anywhere where the okay.
Does that form the true for I equals J?
For?
Does that form the true for I equals J also?
Well, yes, exactly. You wouldn't call it epistasis necessarily. So, but in principle, this is also true for eagles. Well, here, you know, is anyone going to flip the, you know, if you make a mutation from a deleterious to an advantage to the lead at a given site, that selection coefficient changes sign. But, so.
But then you.
Let me.
No, really. But I mean, this, okay, so I'm actually asking about retrenchment. In the model, if something flips, does the rest of the genome adjust so that the flip state is now advantageous?
I think I've stated the model, right? So it keeps sort of, and this is reasonable for protein stability.
Yeah, so
it goes back and forth like here.
It should.
Overall, it is still probably true that something that stabilizes the protein keeps being a stabilizing mutation, but its effect can be a little bit bigger if the protein is anyway more marginal.
We have plenty of data for that.
Okay, so now let's go and say, this was only selection, right? We haven't talked about evolution yet. What's the consequences on the evolutionary dynamics? Because after all, that's what we observe, right? So, of course, like you can you can look at mutation rate of single sites. So, and of course, a mutation, as we already discussed, can go either up or down. In many cases, in our data inference, we will not know the trait. So we don't know whether a given mutation goes up or down with respect to the trait. So in recording mutation rate, we will be inclined to sum over these two possibilities. And that's then the total mutation rate observed at a given site I. We want to study pairs of mutations because we argued that there is a window of epistasis. So pair mutation rates should differ from the single site rates. And indeed, this is what one finds in this simplest model. So if we now, I forgot to say this. Let's do the simplest equilibrium dynamics, right? We are just moving in this toy model without any extra addition by, say, genetic drift and mutations and so on. So then we have these pair rates. Indeed, what one finds is that then the observed pair rate is enhanced over this characteristic time, over the product of the single site rate. So this window, this is very intuitive, right? The window of epistasis generates a window in which the pair emission probability is going to be distinct from the product of the single site mutation rates, which you could just think of looking over long times in a population recording the average rate of at a given site.
Sorry, and now I'm totally lost. What dynamics have you now introduced?
For example, an evolutionary dynamics, say a Fisher-Wright model, where the sites move by genetic drift, mutations in this fitness landscape.
But the mutation rate is a substitution.
Here, yeah, this is a substitution rate. Mm-hmm. Or, yeah, we will qualify this as a...
So you're in the more. Limit of the product of population size and mutation rate is small.
I'm in the limit where the product of mutation rate and population size and mutation rate is small. So...
small and full linkage or no linkage?
At this point, it doesn't matter so much if the trait is not very polymorphic. So this is probably, for these protein stability that we're talking, this is a reasonable thing. So, and this response matrix has a very simple form. It is, again, it is just the square of, at least for the relevant sites, it's the square of this selection matrix. So it's, again, a symmetric rank one matrix that is positive for the relevant site pairs, meaning the ones with an appreciable effect on this trait, meaning that we observe more pair mutations close in sites that are epistatically correlated, right? So if there's a first one, there's going to be more likely to be a second one within this window of epistatic selection of size tau zero. So here's again a picture of this.
So you're saying that if there's one, let's go back to the phenotype, okay? You have different two mutations that go, one that goes down, one that goes up with high amplitude. You mentioned that as soon as they affect the phenotype, one's going to be correlated, the evolution, the coevolution between the two somehow, and that it's going to be linked to their relative impact on the trait, independently of the sign.
Well, not independently of the sign, we have some view of the sign. So it's clear that some mutations are suppressed, some are enhanced. The first order term exactly cancels out, and there's a second order term, and this is why this is the square of this. So the net effect of the dynamics is, I haven't shown this in detail, the net effect is that, however very intuitive, that there is an enhancement of pairs at sites that are epistatically correlated, of close by pairs. And this is going to be the basis of this inference. But now,
the enhancement occurs because there are times when one is down and one is up.
If you sum over these four possibilities and sum this all up, in the end, it's a net enhancement. Yeah. That's the statement. So there's one
addition. So how can this not depend on things like population size? I don't understand this. I mean, the probability for such a mutant to spread will depend on S times N.
Of course it does. I mean, these are all selection coefficients that are proportional to this. There are factors of effective population sizes, which I haven't written down here. Of course, this is standard population genetics here, the dependence on population size, which I haven't written down. I've just written down how it depends on the or the matrix structure of this.
I guess the difficult thing here is, and that's a little bit confusing to me and I guess others. So this fitness landscape, that's absolute fitness, right? But we think a lot about relative fitness, right? So let's say when the mutation can invade, and so on, what's going on the population level. Like also this epistatic effects, they basically arise because S1 mutation, if you assume that it would go to fixation, that would change the fitness of the population, that would change the selection coefficients of the new mutations that will come up, because you're the population set a new spot on this fitness landscape.
It's not absolute selection, it's standard selection coefficient, right?
It's epistatic interactions are not initially, it's assumed that mutation is polymorphic for one allele. So now one side flips, so that not immediately gives rise to these epistatic interactions, right? Because that's still at really low fitness. And let's say if you want to ask whether this mutation invades or not, it's still just its selection coefficient, and the other mutations don't yet have a different selection coefficient. Right?
They do, right? I mean, if you make a change,
particular individual, but you're saying on average in the population they don't. I think that's the discrepancy.
I see. So if that mutation would also arise in that specific individual, you would have less selection coefficient. But if it arises in a different individual, whatever.
He's in the weak mutation limit. Things are fixing one at a time.
Yeah, there's no polymorphism.
Right. There is no, I mean, things remain, the structure remains the same even if you crank up a little bit of the population size, and what then happens is you get a width of the population that is finite on that fitness landscape. As long as that width is small against changes of the curvature of this fitness landscape, exactly the same thing is also true for larger population sizes. But you may think the easiest thing is to really have a substitution dynamics here. Think of this is the most intuitive way to think about it.
Right? It's difficult if you assume that two of them are segregated at the same size, at the same time. Then it gets.
Let's really think of them as consecutive. It's absolutely. So I need to get a little bit.
On the last slide, when you said the correlations are stronger for pairs that are close.
Including in terms of.
Is it close in terms of size of effect? Is that what you mean?
Yeah. No, in terms of time, right? So the effect is always the product of the two sizes. So of course, if both EI and EJ are bigger, the effect is a bilinear form in the EIs, but it decays over this time window, right? So that also makes sense, right? You in this fast evolving population, you observe it some protein position, some in influenza, you observe some change. 10 years later, many things have happened. So, in fact, in this example, this decay time is about 2 years. I need to get a little bit less toy in this model, because this is a nice model, it's solvable and so on, but it's not realistic for these examples that we want to look at. In particular, in these fast evolving populations that we're all interested in, a trait like this is never alone, right? Even the protein stability, there is, one has to say, what is maybe compromising that stability? This protein has to maybe adapt to the binding of an antibody. This thing has to still bind to the cell. It still should not decay as a protein. So there are several traits involved, some of them under adaptive pressure, others maybe under less. So there's one minimal ingredient missing in this picture, and this is the adaptation. The thing that we should not think of a quiet equilibrium process where something is just a mutation selection balance. This is not for these adaptive processes a very far-fetching thing, and we will see this forces us to think about one more structural element in the theory. So here I show you what I think is arguably the simplest way how you can add an adaptive pressure to this model. And we're doing it here just by introducing single site effects in addition to this trait, so something external that can change over time. So if you think, for example, as your trait, as protein stability, now this this viral protein, for example, has to escape an antibody binding. So some sites of this protein have to change. This would be our orange selection. So maybe these immune antibodies change in the host population. They force an antigenic change. This protein should still not decay. So this trait lives in the context of an adaptive process.
Like a site-specific magnetic field?
This would be a site-specific time-dependent magnetic field, if you will.
Remember that in this area of physics talk, flip it on.
And our order parameter is the total magnetization, right? And the other fitness was a function of the total magnetization only. This is one possible non-equilibrium. Of course, you could invent other kinds of possible non-equilibrium. And then you can, and lots of things stay the same if you do that calculation. There are still single site rates. There is now, we will permit ourselves one more thing to distinguish between first and second. Now we break the detailed balance, right? So there's something like Krasimski and others have called driver and trailer mutations in this context. So you can think of them as the ones that happen first and the other ones that are more or less the compensatory mutations. They also turn out to be the ones that sort of more at these orange sites that are the ones that are in this adaptive process. We will see this in more detail in a moment. And trailer, so we permit ourselves two distinct single site rates at these at site I and at site J. Otherwise, the structure of these pair rates is exactly the same, with one exception, that the matrix, this response matrix, is no longer a symmetric matrix. And without going into the calculational details, this is quite intuitive as well. If you think, for example, that a site, a given site, has a strong orange component in its fitness. So it's doing its own spiel. It's not responding so much to compensatory things of this trait because it's under strong selection by itself, like, for example, an antigenic site on this protein, while other sites are doing the compensation. So what it turns out that this matrix can be written as the symmetric equilibrium matrix times a damping factor that gets stronger if this external selection gets stronger. I think that's quite intuitive. So these driver sites where the orange music is playing, they are less responding to other trait sites, but of course, because they're part of this trait, they can still generate response by other sites. So this matrix is now going to become an asymmetric. It is still a rank one matrix.
But do they increase the rate of the epistatic interaction at the other sites? Do they increase the
probability? Yes. They might also, you know, it gets now complicated a bit. They might slow down a bit the trait efficiency of this compensatory process and so on. But they would probably enhance the rate at these sites. Well, they would. The thing would go down a little bit on this fitness landscape, and therefore all the rates will be enhanced a bit. All right, now can we make use of this to infer things from sequence data? So here is kind of a tree, like the ones that I've shown for influenza, right? So here's the time axis, is time ordered sequence data. We sequence all this population over time. So these are, so in the influenza case, these are viral isolates, collected from all sorts of places over a period of now 4.5 decades. And we're just going to count pairs, right? So we're going to, in this tree, associate mutations that happen in a codon number I and the codon number J at given places on the tree, as marked here by given clades, given nodes of this tree. So we're going to map all mutations onto this node that is directly below them. And then we're going to sum up over all of these clades in the population, all of these upper clades alpha that contain a mutation at site I, and then the nested clades, which are of which alpha is on the background, which contain a mutation at site J. And we're going to use our exponential thing, because that's what we are interested in, to capture things that are in this window of selection. So is that clear? This is a simple counting exercise on this tree.
How do you get the tau?
The tau here, well, from the data, we, in this case, in the case of influenza that I'm going to show you, we have an a priori knowledge that the coalescence time of this tree is of the order 2 or 3 years, and this turns out to be the most informative thing. So you would take roughly, if you would start this analysis, you would start with something of order of the coalescence time and then vary it and see if you get more significant results.
But at this point, you want to restrict it to non-synonymous.
These are these are all non-synonymous mutations.
It's, in fact, it's every virus, synonymous could be.
Synonymous could be, it depends on the trait that we are thinking of. And here, in this particular case, what we did is non-synonymous mutations.
But we're still sort of acting in a model where we're imagining that every dot on this tree is a substitution in the entire population.
Well, this is not true here, because this tree is the entire population. Now here, so it is a substitution. That's a good question, right? Thanks for pointing this out. This is something that has reached a certain threshold in frequency on the entire population, so that it's visible in this sample of sequences that make up this tree. So here we're using a threshold frequency of the order of 2 or 5%. It turns out that already, so it's, you can think of it as sublineages that have 2 or 5% and it's a substitution in that sublineage. And it turns out that this has already some signature of selection to have it made in that population until that frequency where we take it here above our threshold. Of course, at very small frequencies, this is a nonsensical procedure, because mutations get more and more neutral at small frequencies, and these epistasis effects don't play out, right? But it turns out in this particular example, at the frequency where we start noticing those mutations, there's already selective effects, and we'll see that. So then we see correlations already at those frequencies, although it's not a full substitution, but just the condition of having reached this threshold frequency.
But you're assuming that at any given time there is one main branch, sort of one?
No, I mean, it turns out a posteriori there's a trunk of this tree, as with all these sort of trees under strong selection, but we can at every point in time, saying at a given time window here, we just count all the strains. That gives us a notion of frequency in that population, and we then cut at a certain threshold. So we cut this tree to a certain level of coarse grain.
Are you using the coalescence time just because it's like the only obvious time scale on the problem?
Yeah, and you know, then we vary a bit, and we see that for this is quite robust. So what I'm going to show you below can be gotten, you know, with anything between using a time window of 1 year or 2 years, because it doesn't really matter so much. We want to get these close pairs. If you choose the time a little bit too short, you just get a little bit less signal. It's not distorting it in any serious way. It's just making it a bit weaker.
Yeah,
So you can actually vary it and maximize the signal if you wish. So that's.
How quantitative is this trait? I mean, I have no idea about the determinism of this trait. Like, how quantitative is it?
We will see. We will see. I will show you the trait in a moment. So now we need to say, well, we can make probabilistic models, and these are the ones that I've introduced, so that we have a null model where mutations are independent, and an epistatic model where mutations come from this pair rate process that we've just discussed.
Is there a reason why you're trying to not learn the EI, why you're only trying to learn these correlations?
That's another good question. I think we're going to see it on the next slide. So these quantities here, these model parameters, they're just three, P, I, Q, J, and this pair correlation or response matrix rho I, J. They're just three things to be learned, and one can learn them. That the maximum likelihood model parameters can be obtained in a straightforward way from this count matrix. Namely, these PI are just the sum over the partial sums over rows. These are the partial sums over column. This is the total number of counts in this matrix. You normalize them. And the rho ij, the maximum likelihood rho ij, is just the deviation of the actual observed counts minus what you would observe under this null model, the excess counts. Now, the problem is that these matrices are, in all problems, at least that I can think of, including the one that we are discussing, always terribly undersampled, right? So you never get a good count of mutational pair frequencies for all the sites I, j. Even in the simple thing of a single protein, this is a space of 600 codons times 600 codons. It's a big matrix in principle. And most this data set that is sufficient accuracy available maybe for over the last 15 years just has a number of mutations. So you get some entries and some numbers of mutations and some entries I, j. But other parts of this matrix have just zero pairs of mutations because it never happened that something got in codon I and immediately or a year later in codon J. So this matrix is very undersampled, and that's why a probabilistic analysis is necessary.
I wonder whether a model with no epistatic interaction but fluctuating fitness over fluctuation scale tau would look similar to this or very different to the epistatic model? Because it would also lead to the correlations in the mutations. Right?
It would not generically lead to this asymmetry though, that we're discussing. But let's see. I mean, where we get. So what we do now, remembering that quantitative traits are giving rise to simple epistasis. To rank one matrices, we're going to look for rank one matrices in this big matrix. And of course, the thing to do this is a singular value decomposition of this matrix. And I think this is now what we think we have a very clean correspondence between the algebraic structure of this matrix and the likelihood analysis that we would like to do. And this correspondence here in a nutshell is that the eigenvectors are the amplitudes of given sites here on this driver side and on this trailer side. There's now, because it's an asymmetric matrix, there's a left eigenvector and a right eigenvector to each of these singular components. And the eigenvalue is related to the statistical significance. You can write down the statistical significance as a function of the eigenvalue. And
how do you define statistical significance?
I will do this here instantaneously. So it turns out that to get the so given the idiosyncrasies of this tree, one still has to do a scrambling test and so on. So I will not tell you exactly how one computes this p-value. I'm happy to tell you this in private. But so here is the probability that for a given quantitative trait associated with a given singular component of this matrix, and here is the cumulative fraction of this response matrix explained by these sectors. So the fraction of the total Frobenius norm of this matrix explained. Now, so let's start with this quantitative trait. So the two biggest eigensector, k equals 1 and k equals 2, they are both statistically significant. They are below some cutoff. Then there are further sectors which are not statistically significant, so we discard them. In addition, we can query the same matrix for individual site pairs, for individual points I, j, where the counts are strongly higher than what would be expected from the null model plus the quantitative trait model, so where the counts at individual site pairs cannot be explained within these, between the two quantitative traits. What we find is kind of interesting. We find only six or couples of individual points that are strongly correlated and cannot be explained by these quantitative traits. We call them Mendelian pairs. So these are individual site pairs. And then we find two broad classes. I'll show them in a moment on the protein.
Okay.
So this was just as an example sort of for the significance analysis. So it's quite straightforward. One can do a singular value decomposition. Then one gets low rank putative traits, right? Each of them has a left and a right eigenvector and an eigenvalue, and then one can query individual for the statistical significance for each of them.
So sorry, just at this point, is it obvious that the left eigenvalue is the trial limitation and the right is the trail?
It is, no, at this point, it is just, if you remember, the asymmetry here came from just counting pairs. So this was it turns out that if you count pairs, I, j, they are time-ordered pairs here, right? Then this matrix is allowed to be asymmetric, and it is asymmetric. We're going to get closer to the reasons why this is asymmetric when we look at actually where this is on the protein, what this does, what these sites are. So maybe in the final part of this talk, your question will be addressed. So this is...
Sorry, initially you talked about one trait affecting the fitness, and then you have a rank one matrix, and here you have arbitrary ranks. So does it mean that you also have an underlying theory for fitness that depends quadratically on an arbitrary number of traits? Each of them follows the same dynamics to the trial.
Well, so in the data, of course, you get a matrix. You take this count matrix.
Right,
that there is, yeah, so there is, we get a arbitrarily high rank. So it is true when you have, when you now have a theory that, for example, has two traits, that then it becomes more complicated. One has to say, are they very pleiotropic? Do they overlap in their site content and so on? So we don't have a very precise model for that, right? So we...
I mean, I think what you're doing here, we should focus on the inference side, that you have a null model where there's no interaction, and then you contrast that with a model with interactions, and we can forget that you sort of motivated it with this energies and all that, and just treat it as inference and then analyze your...
That's one way of thinking about it. The reason for this first part was only, as you say, to motivate that there is a very natural way to think how one gets easy, in the sense of rank one epistasis, when we think of quantitative traits.
Right,
The
next step is that you put two traits and say that your fitness is a quality.
We have not done that in detail.
Then you should find a rank two.
You find rank two, right? I mean, you find something at minimum. Yeah, you find something rank two. What this precise structure of this thing is, if it can still be written in the same form. So for a single trait, rank one. For two traits, rank two. That's probably still true. But it may not be exactly that analytical formula. So these are sort of the realm of these toy models. And now let's, as Alex suggests, focus on this inference. So here is what you
on
get.
The inference, the Mendelian stuff does not naturally come out of the SVD. You have to.
It's kind of like in quantum mechanics. So what comes out is like it's not, these would not be eigenstates of this matrix, right? Because you condition that, you say I want something which lives only at one point I comma j, and there it's a very simple statistical problem, right? You have a certain expected count, which is just the pi times qj, right? It's just the product of the single side rates, and only for those sites where you get many more counts than expected from that, you would pick them out. And it turns
out stuff would come out with the null module also, right? Because it's the pi qj.
No, it's also a deviation from the null module, right? It's kind of like at an individual, I will show you in a moment. And so I should say maybe for this, this came to us a little bit as a surprise, because this looking point by point was done before in papers by Krajewski and by Neverov et al. And so on. They find many more pairs. We now think that most of these pairs are probably false positives and can be explained by these broad traits. And only a few pairs, namely here six, survive a statistical a significance analysis.
So you're saying you first took out the first principal components and then looked in the pair somehow in the residual, or you just...
You can do several things. This is what I showed here. The site pairs, the individual site pairs that remain significant in the matrix where you take out the two first quantitative traits.
That's what you've
right?
done.
That's okay. We have also done other things. You can do also, like, for example, you look only in the space of epitopes and look, are there significant pairs and so on, and forget about these quantitative traits, you get a slightly different list. But what this says, that many of these enhanced or reduced counts compared to the null model can be explained by these broad traits.
By which you just mean this overall shape of the landscape.
Well, by which, yeah, so I'm, I...
It is, they're, you know, the Krajewski, whatever, they're finding real epistasis, but it's just a sort of, that you could explain it with this kind of general epistasis.
They are finding close pairs on the tree.
Yeah.
That's what they're finding. And the question is, is it a significant count of epistasis? And if you look at a significance analysis of these pairs, in this undersampled matrix, not many of these pairs are significant.
In the sense that you subtract what you would call like macroscopic epistasis of the landscape, and you just pass idiosyncrasy. Like for instance, this would presumably result from non-additive effect on the phenotype level somehow. No.
I mean, the point is, if you you take your matrix and you pick. That there's a big multiple testing correction that you have to actually have to apply, right? Because even if you have your additive model and you take a big matrix, there's always a few, it's n squared possibilities, right? If you seriously subtract that, not many pairs survive anyway. You can do a little bit better if you say, okay, let me not count on the whole protein, but look, for example, just in subspaces where I'm interested in, like the epitopes or so, just 50 codons or something. And look whether I get significant counts there. You get a few more than these six, but it's a few pairs that stick out. So this is like, just to get, maybe I suggest I just show you a bit the concrete thing, and maybe some of the questions become clearer anyway. So this is just our inferred response matrix row, but from this counting exercise. And the maximum likelihood, you don't see at first sight too much structure. When we now then take the two leading eigen sectors, then this is what you get. They're now ordered here. They are driver amplitudes and trailer amplitudes. So this is for each site, the left and right eigenvalue component. In fact, in this subspace of two eigenvalues, one still does a rotation, to make things more associated with individual sites. This is maybe a little bit of a technical detail. There's these two traits. So this is trait number one, and this is trait number two. And you can see there is a broad correlation in that subspace. This is rank one plus noise, and here's the other rank one plus noise. And then there is somewhere here, we anyway truncated from these about 300 amino acid positions to about 80, where using a minimum number of counts that we get in a given cell. So, you know, lots of this influenza protein, you never see a single mutation. It's like something where you change that amino acid and you don't see any mutation in 40 years. It's a boring position. It falls out of the dynamics. So that means it's probably lethal if you change something over there. So the remaining space that we're working here, our base space was about 80 times 80. And here's the six Mendelian pairs. And you can see they don't stick out very much in this original thing. But that's like when you subtract what you can explain by the null model plus the two broad rank one matrices. All right.
Should I be surprised that it doesn't look very asymmetric to me?
Should you be surprised? Well, okay. Good question. It is asymmetric. So here they are. These numbers here and these site positions are ordered by their coefficient in these eigenvalues. So here it must look symmetric because we display it that way.
Okay.
Right. So these are. When you map them back on the protein, they are other columns and so on. So this is like, and even this order here is not the same as this order. If you would display it different, you wouldn't see this rank one so well, but then you would see the asymmetry.
Wait, what order is not the same as order?
Sorry?
What two orders are different?
This number five here is not the same amino acid position as this number five, because they are ordered here by descending amplitude in this eigenvector and by descending amplitude in this eigenvector. And because that the left and the right eigenvector, this corresponds to a different labeling. This is the ordering which makes this broadness or rank one. Look, this is the same thing that we have chosen here, right, in our toy model. When we order them by descending trait component, then you see, okay, here it's big elements and here it's small elements because the element size is EI, EJ. Right? So we chose the same ordering here. If you scramble this one and this one, you would also not see that it's sort of a simple matrix. It can make any simple matrix with heterogeneous elements also look complicated. And this is, in fact, what you see here. Right. This is how it looks before the ordering.
Sorry, Nicholas. So I mean, these eigenvectors are related to the effects on the eyes that you had in the initial.
So the eigenvectors are just they are not directly the effects. This comes back to your question. We first wanted to go after the effects, and then we realized the effects are actually not the EIs are not easy to come by because they are masked by additional dynamical features if we take this seriously, even in the sort of these semi-simple models where we add adaptation to this trait, we try to make them semi-realistic, then there would be a corresponding inverse problem to be solved to get at the underlying EIs. But then I now would like to argue that this dynamical response matrix is actually, for practical purposes, the more informative matrix, because it says these are the ones that take part in the actual correlated dynamics. So the EIE, it's still a rank one matrix, but rows and columns of the response matrix, as we've seen, are modified compared to the bare outer product of the effects because...
So I finished my sentence. But if you just look at conservation, that's another piece of information. You haven't been using conservation and the distribution of amino acid sites.
over the entire tree?
I'm not sure.
In fact, the magnetization and excitement. So you have the correlation matrix of mutations, and then you just have the frequency of each variant that you send, right?
Right. And
conservation and multiple sequences.
Yeah, sure. I mean, this
and
goal.
That's information that hasn't been used. Yeah, I was wondering whether it could be.
It has been used in form of these single site rates. So it enters, it doesn't enter the precise amino acid content, but the amount of conservation enters in these PI and QJ.
So I don't understand why it's hard to get the EIs, because you wrote down equations that said that your rho ij is EI squared A,
yeah,
J squared.
That was in the simple example with one trait, and now he's looking at many traits, so he doesn't have the theory. He doesn't have the equivalent equations for the data he's looking at.
So
isn't it still true that then the weights of the eyes in these PCA in the SED components must be the ER, must be interpreted as the EIs?
No, that's no longer true, right? Because if you put the trait in the context of something else, like I showed you, like I can go back to this. Here is an explicit example in the. Here's, for example, where this trait evolves under this driven state by external selection. This was our orange selection in addition to the fitness landscape of the trait. If you think of the fitness landscape of the trait, for example, as stability, and you force the protein to do something else, an adaptive motion that is external to that, then the response matrix, that's quite, has to somehow be a product of both of these dynamical inputs. And it is, and in this case, it's rather simple. It's the equilibrium matrix, which is just the product of EI or EJ, actually here EI squared and EJ squared. But then there's an additional modification factor that says if a site is very fixed by the orange selection, does not take part in the response side. And this is, for example, creating here these depleted response columns in this matrix. This is one example how in a more complex scenario, which is not just the boring scenario of one trait in an isolated universe, the dynamics is a convolution of these selection ingredients. And there is actually, if one wanted to get better on that, there would be an inverse problem to solve, phases of which we have discussed, right? So your question about the two traits goes in the same direction. One would this it becomes then a complicated thing, the dynamics, the net product of all these inputs, and the individual inputs are more difficult to disentangle. But the net, it is still true, and this is like why it doesn't matter so much, it is still true that this lives on the trait side, and on the trait side it's a low rank, it's a rank one matrix per trait. Right. So this is the most important thing for the inference. So we wanted to ask for this particular example, what's the biology of this, what we get? Is this a mathematical exercise, or do we get anything tangible? Have we learned anything about this protein? So this is the last couple of slides here. So when we take, for example, our inferred drivers, and this is sort of answering your question, what are the drivers, are they? We see this a bit a posteriori. So they are under unconditional positive selection. They have a fixation probability that is twice as much as the one of neutral sites, and that's sort of the typical thing that we get for these antigenic sites that are on the antigenic epitopes. And so the trailers, it's a different story, and maybe the more interesting stories. They have also a strongly enhanced fixation probability, but only when they are following a driver mutation of the same eigen component, right? So when they are epistatic, when there was a green mutation, then that follow-up mutation has a high chance of getting fixed.
How do you fixation probabilities?
We can look, right, on this tree, right? So they are on the trunk in the end, they are fixed. So this can be seen by inspection on the tree.
Trunk
versus non-trunk, exactly.
Does it tell us anything about dielectric in that case between the two traits, or?
Good question. We can debate it. Whether I'm not sure. If they are not epistatic, if there wasn't a driver, then this is insignificant. They don't have enhanced fixation probability. So this is consistent with the interpretation that these trailers are kind of primarily the ones that compensate the stuff that the drivers do, and the drivers are a bit more autonomous, a bit like preempted by this sort of second model with the external selection plus the trait.
Should anything be made of the red bar being larger than the green bar?
I'm not sure whether this is statistically significant.
Can a trailer become a driver for another trailer?
Can, yes. We're just counting pairs, right? With all the confounding factors that we may not count one thing. I mean, it's true, and the real process too, right? It can become a trailer, but we're sort of truncating this to pair effects. But then driver sites are involved in antigenic adaptation. So they are the ones that we see just from this exercise, from this algebraic exercise, are 60% unknown epitope sites. And interestingly, they show a conservation of hydrophobicity. So you can now look for known biological traits that these individual amino acids, like how hydrophobic they are, or what charge they have, and so on. And you can look over time, like what is the degree of conservation of a given trait. Taking a very simple measure, we take the variance of a stretch of mutations and compare it to the additive variance that is the sum of the square of the effects of the individual mutations. So if this is a 40% conservation, means the total variance is 40% less than the additive variance, meaning that you have a fair amount of compensatory mutation that go in the opposite direction that these mutations are anti-correlated in their direction. So these mutations, the driver sites, show hydrophobicity conservation, and that means that's reasonable for sites that are involved in this antigenic process with the immune system. They have to remain on the surface of the protein. The trailer sites are a little bit different. They are more broadly distributed in the protein, and they show the only significant conservation they show is charge. So this, we interpret this as being consistent with they are less under selection pressure to change their charge, for example, to escape an antibody pressure. So they keep their charge more likely than the ones the driver sites would like to change their charge.
How many of them are surface?
Well, I'm going to show you this on the structure just in a moment. And the Mendelian site pairs, we find a good fraction of them are overlapped with the binding site pocket. So I can show you here. So this is like this is the HA1 domain where most of the dynamics is playing. The rest is HA2. This protein is a dimer. So here is a driver site of trait 1 and trait 2 in green. I'm going to scroll forward. This is the trailer sites. So they are kind of neighboring each other. And here for comparison is shown the known epitope sites. So most of them are sort of this sites plus flanking sites. And here's sort of these Mendelian. So here is sort of the site pair 193, 157 sits in here. 193 and 158. So the Mendelian pairs, most of them are in a localized region. There's one pair that sits out here, and there's sort of two pairs that are not visible because they're more in the interior. And so on. For comparison, here is the known binding site pocket of this protein. So we see that this algebraic exercise teaches us an incomplete story, but some part of a biological story of this protein evolution in this fast evolution. So let me just conclude by saying if this should read quantitative trait evolution, I'm sorry. So for the evolution of quantitative traits generates generically broad correlations, broad in the sense that all the sites take part in it, and they take part of it in a relatively simple way, as described by a rank one matrix. So nothing rugged, nothing complicated, and this is why in the end there can also be identified. Then, if you have an adaptive process, and I guess most of the processes that we all are interested in, populations are fast evolving and adapting, then something specific happens to these correlations. They become asymmetric in time and also asymmetric in the site content, because some of these sites are more the leaders and others are more the trailers, and this is reflected in that algebraic structure in the correlation. And this was for us one of the sort of things about these correlations are intrinsically equilibrium methods, right? We write down a Hamiltonian with an interaction to I will say, but this is very equilibrium, whilst these populations are surely far away from an equilibrium. And but a lot of these correlations can be made sense of in a similar way, except they lose the symmetry property intrinsic to equilibrium. Qualitative protein theories can be inferred from temporal proximity of mutations in a sequence tree. And finally, for human influenza, these traits are in the described way linked to the evolution of antigenicity. Thank you.
If you go back to DCA versus sector, then would you find the traits that you find in Mendelian? Do you really find them with DCA direct coupling analysis? The others not? Or, and are your sectors overlapping or something?
We haven't tried the DCA on the Mendelian traits. It's clear we would not find the quantitative traits by standard sector analysis. And the reason is, I should go back very much to the beginning where I showed the tree, right? So this is a fast evolving population. If you were just to look at an alignment, look at, you know, the mutual information between two alignment columns, it's a highly distorted measure of the evolutionary correlation. So for example, if a mutation happens here, then there's only sort of five, the portion of the alignment where one pair of allele occurs is very small, and the other pair of allele occurs in a big part of the tree. If a mutation occurs here, it would split this thing into 50-50. So the mutual information just does not work for these time order trees here. So one needs a dynamical...
Just in further questions outside to the lounge area, because the staff here has asked about 4 or 5 so that they can clean up and go home at 5 o'clock. Right up here.
Not that dirty.